Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
You know, as a first-generation Mexican-American in the United States, the experience is one of never knowing whether you're Mexican or American, or enough of either one, or too much of either one for any given situation. When you mature, you realize that it's not a question you need to be asking yourself, and you can proudly be both.
And all.
And all. I hope that the restaurants reflect that.
That's Carlos Salgado. He grew up working in his parents' Mexican restaurant, La Siesta, in Orange County. After attending culinary school and training as a pastry chef at Qua and Comi in Northern California, Salgado returned home to open Taco Maria, first the truck, then the acclaimed restaurant. Now the 37-year-old chef is serving his Alta California cuisine at King's Highway, a roadside diner that used to be a Denny's in Palm Springs. For listeners who haven't been lucky enough to eat at Taco Maria or at King's Highway in the past month, how do you describe your take on Alta California cuisine?
Taco Maria is quite different from King's Highway at the Ace, of course. They're different sides of my personality, I suppose. Taco Maria is sort of about self-discovery and my own identity, studying my family and their history and our origins, family recipes, memories of growing up, and the shared memories that Mexican-American kids have of growing up in Mexican households, where all the different ethnic cuisines that are available here in the United States make their way into our food at home. So as a Mexican-American kid, you grow up with an interesting take on what authentic Mexican food is. At Taco Maria, it's a bit quieter. We take a back seat. We like to let the food speak for itself and the stories communicate themselves on the plate. Whereas at the Ace, I get to explore like other stonier parts of my personality, I guess, which is to say, like, at Taco Maria, it wouldn't necessarily make sense to make a bacon-wrapped Sonora dog, although I'm sure I would sell a lot of them. In fact, I think I'm going to go ahead and do that. But at the Ace Hotel and Swim Club in Palm Springs, if you haven't been, when you go, you'll know that it wouldn't make sense to not sell a bacon-wrapped Sonora dog poolside. So Alta California Cuisine, it's a banner that I carry proudly, and I'm proud to be working in the same time and place with so many creative and really thoughtful chefs with immigrant backgrounds. But for me, it's an exploration of this identity, as they say, like, between the hyphens.
Give me an idea of, in your household, how the sort of panoply of American food ended up on the plate in your particular house. Give me like one dish.
The one that always sticks out to me, like when LA was going through its, modern taco truck period. And of course, I have so much respect for Roy and what he and Daniel Patterson, you know, my mentor and former chef.
From Qua.
Are doing from Qua, yes, in San Francisco. Before I met Roy, I always laughed at the Korean taco thing because I thought, my dad invented this when I was 12 years old. You know, because you grew up in a Mexican-American household, and whatever's coming in for takeout, Chinese or Korean or Thai food.
Or a hot dog.
Yeah, exactly. You know, at the table, because mom and dad didn't have time to cook, of course there's going to be tortillas on the plancha. And of course there's going to be salsas. And you know, I remember the first time I saw my dad put Kung Pao chicken in a tortilla.
It's a genius idea.
It is a genius idea. And then spoon over a bunch of, habanero salsa. And we eat weird fusion tacos at home in Mexican-American households. And we've been doing so for a long time.
We're devoting this entire show to the role that immigrants play in bringing us our food. And you've talked about being a first-generation Mexican-American. Your parents immigrated to California from Mexico before you were born. We've spoken about this before and how painful their restaurant life sometimes was for you. What role did their life in the restaurant business play in your life, and how did watching them work how they did affect your decision to stay in the restaurant business?
My parents are a tremendous influence on me. When I was younger, I thought that the work that they did was simple, pedestrian,
menial,
lower class, menial, servile.
You were embarrassed by it.
Truth be told, yes, I was. And I think that's true for a lot of lower class immigrant kids growing up in the United States. And I went off and had a technology career right out of high school, actually starting in high school. And I was making my way up the ladder, so to speak, designer and programmer, working in the video game industry, making more money than I knew what to do with. it took me a while to realize why I was unfulfilled. And it was because the work that I was in, I was moving further and further away from my family and my culture, from their language, from the traditions, from the sounds and the smells and the language. And I eventually realized that I was only moving away and that I would lose it if I continued. And I was laid off and got a nice severance package and, you know, lived selfishly in San Francisco, ostensibly looking for new work in that industry, and realized that the only joy in my life at that time was discovering the mission and the Little Mexican markets and seeing ingredients from my childhood and, you know, cooking for myself and family and friends. I realized that I could still apply all of my intelligence and all of my artistic sensitivity in a medium that was much more fulfilling, much more emotional and evocative and connected with people in a direct way. As I see now, the technology industry is largely devoid of real human emotion. So I'm glad that I left it. I'm glad that I escaped and was able to recover. And now I can't imagine doing anything else. I'll die in the kitchen.
I have to say that there are few foods as emblematic to place as corn is for Mexico. You've talked about your obsession with corn before with us. You say it's at the heart of what you do at Taco Maria, Sin Maíz No Hay País. Without corn, there's no country. Does that have greater significance now for you, given that the Trump administration is talking about perhaps changing a lot with trade?
Absolutely. Corn has been ultimately important to my work for the last 5 or 6 years. Our explorations into our identity in Mexican food start with corn, because while European cuisines enjoy the benefit of, say, DOP or AOC designations for wines and cheeses and vinegars and
denominations
whatnot.
Of origin.
Yes. You know, and there's cultural artifacts that are revered and storied and emotional and very important to people. Mexico is not seen that way, despite the fact that it has probably a greater diversity of cuisines and ingredients and farming traditions and than most smaller European countries. You know, corn is no different.
You've been pretty vocal on social media about what you think of our new president's policies on immigration. And on February 16th, when many restaurant workers didn't go to work as part of a national effort to protest Trump's immigration policies, you tweeted out, "Taco Maria was built by immigrants and their descendants. Today, we donate 100% of profits to the ACLU in support of hashtag Day Without Immigrants." What has it been like so far being a restaurateur under Trump?
Well, I've been primed and prepared for this administration by the, you know, microcosm that is conservative Orange County. Proposing to put out, quote-unquote, expensive Mexican food in a relatively conservative part of the country, as well as growing up in an immigrant family and in a family Mexican restaurant, we've seen all this before. And we're well-rehearsed to deal with the systemic and institutional racism, the microaggressions. They've thickened our skin over the course of many years. I think the real effect on the ground right now is a spiritual one.
Fear?
Absolutely. In fact, I had a chef, a cook that was deported this morning. I got a call from him at 6 a.m. And we're all shaken right now, obviously.
Was he deported with his whole family, or was he separated from his family?
I don't know enough yet. I haven't been able to talk to him. I just had a series of text messages when I woke up this morning, which is really sad. So I'm going to go find out what's next. But we're now living in a world where people feel emboldened to retaliate against immigrants for any reason whatsoever by notifying immigration control, which is a terrifying thing to live under. If you have an angry neighbor, if you have a competitor, this is a very real fear that people have now. And while we don't yet know how it'll play out, we can assume a few things. We can assume that prices in our food and in the operation of our business will go up. A cost for us, at the restaurant, and ultimately prices will have to go up for the guest as well. We know that in every industry that supports restaurants, the entire supply chain of food and energy and everything else that we use as a raw material, labor, everything is compromised. And so we can expect that our costs will go up and that our profits will continue to go down. It makes it more difficult still than it already is. I'm sure many of your listeners already are well educated on the the challenges of the restaurant industry, and especially serving responsible food and being responsible towards your employees and your guests.
So I have to ask this. This is kind of a weird detour, but you grew up in Orange County. It's the home of the famous mouse. A huge number of Latino workers work at Disneyland or for businesses that support Disneyland, surround Disneyland. Have you started to hear anything about how Disney or Disneyland is, the hotels or the restaurants, how they're dealing with any of this?
Well, in my own community, I grew up a stone's throw away from Disneyland. We used to watch the fireworks from our backyard because we couldn't afford to go there increasingly. You know, Anaheim, thankfully, has a very activist immigrant population. They're well prepared to fight to protect their community. My view is that if you are Disney, if you are Walmart, if you are Coca-Cola, if you're anyone, and you are not taking a stand on the assault to our culture, I should say our cultures, to our industries, to our rights, to our planet, indeed to our species. If you're not being vocal and you're not taking a position on this, then you can prepare to be defeated in the free market. You will lose, as I said the other day on social media, like you will lose mind share, you will lose market share, you'll lose trust. Disney has been exploiting the local politics of Anaheim for as long as they've existed. While it is a place that's supposed to represent, you know, joy and happiness and peace, it has taken its toll on the local community. The city has stolen resources from the community to give to the park and to its ownership. The police appears to work for the park and for the tourism industry there, and not for the citizens of the community. As I said, while it is a challenging and scary and unknown time to be Mexican-American or to be Mexican in the United States, I have no doubt that they will soon, you know, feel the force of our unrest economically. The privilege of operating a business carries with it a responsibility for a civic duty. And now we're all going to be tested and tried and have to take a position.
Carlos Salgado is the chef and owner of Taco Maria in Orange County, California. You can try his Alta California cuisine there or in Palm Springs at the Ace Hotel's roadside diner, Kings Highway. Trust us, it is worth the drive. Now we turn to another chef and restaurateur in Southern California, Deep Tran.
This is not about affordability. It's about what you value, what you're willing to pay. And somehow, if it's an immigrant restaurant, you're not willing to pay for that.
Tran's family came to the U.S. as refugees from Vietnam in the 1970s and the 80s, eventually settling in California to open a restaurant. She now has her own Vietnamese restaurant in L.A.'s Highland Park neighborhood. It's called Good Girl Dinette. Tran recently wrote a powerful essay for NPR's The Salt blog that covers the implications of exploring immigrant neighborhoods for good, cheap food. Everyone loves a cheap eats list, she writes. A treasure map to $1 tacos, $4 banh mi, $6 pad thai. You say that these lists infuriate you. Why?
I think like in the stages of grief, I usually am stuck in anger most of the time, because actually when I look at those lists, my first reaction is fury. It's because really I'm really sad. It would be very difficult for restaurants to pay people well or ethically with that, you know, that math. If the consumers don't pay for it, it's the workers who pay for it. And so I get very angry and, you know, I hardly ever get to the sad because I can't bear that. So when I was thinking about where the burden lies, I think it's media. I think everybody wants to charge more, you know, and who wants to like slave 16 hours for cut rate prices, but you do it because you think that's what the market will bear. So it's really a call out to media to like, hey, it's just reconsider these lists, because you can say, hey, great neighborhood eats. You can do so many
affordable
things.
Affordable eats.
When it's cheap, it's just like, that's the only thing you care about.
You grew up as a child watching your family work their butts off in pho restaurants.
Yes.
So what did you see that allows you to look at that cheap eat advertisement and see what's behind it?
I mean, I watched my family, but I was also part of that family, that extended family. We made jet lo in the garage. when I came home with jet lo is a kind of like Vietnamese mortadella. We were constantly making stuff. There's a dessert, not like a drink, called sumbolung. And it's like you have to get seaweed and you have to wash it a million times to kind of get a lot of the brine out of it. And then you make a dessert with it. So we did that. Like when we went home, there was always something to do in service of the restaurant. So it wasn't just 16-hour days. It was just every day, all the time. You know, at least my family, there was a path to profit, right?
They were the owners.
Exactly.
But they had employees.
Exactly. They might not work as many hours, but they're still working a million hours. It didn't feel right. But even my family, like, no one wanted us to go into the restaurant business, which is a common thing, I think, anybody who knows about restaurants.
My mother started crying.
Yeah, because you know that the economics is so hard. And then you add on this layer of this almost like a public mandate to have it be cheap on top of it. My family was like, don't do it. It's kind of crazy.
That mandate for it to be cheap, do you think that that is a burden that more often than not falls on certain Asian restaurants?
For sure. I mean, I remember my relatives like, we gotta raise some prices. And they were just worried that like people are not going to enjoy it. They're going to have pushback. And that's like as a child, I heard that. At my restaurant, there would be people who would eat a bowl of pho. I don't know why they didn't look at the prices before. And they're like, this is expensive. This is very, I don't want to pay for this. And they were arguing with me and said, so you're going to skip out on this bill. And they're like, well, this is too much. I'm used to. I'm like, well, the price is clearly written. I said, I'm not going to make you feel bad. You're going to walk out right now. So they feel this entitlement to tell me that I'm doing something
wrong. Even though you're trying to pay your employees better.
Correct. Yes.
And source ingredients from different places.
Correct.
And that costs more.
It does. And I think if you're on a budget, I'm not forcing you to come eat. I had this really weird conversation one time with someone I knew who was a trust fund baby, like true born into wealth, had a trust fund, like kind of worked for fun, you know, and they didn't know I owned a restaurant. It was a group conversation. They're like, oh, yeah, I really love this place, named my restaurant, and says, yeah, too bad it's just kind of expensive for Vietnamese food. And I'm like, you're a trust fund baby. You are not on a budget.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because we focus on immigrants when we speak of restaurant workers, but the reality is that no one earns real money working in a restaurant, especially the owner. But the workers you speak of, particularly the employees of immigrant-owned businesses, are at the lowest rung. Can you talk a bit about the historical exploitation of these workers?
Wage theft happens, I think, on all spectrums. It always is a tricky thing when you just focus on the immigrant restaurant as the only site of exploitation. Wage theft happens in the highest end.
The highest end celebrity chef restaurants.
Yes, it's rampant. I have this experience all the time when I hire a new cook. Their resume is like all these places you see who are like on top list of stuff. And then when they get their first paycheck from me, they look at the paycheck. And they say, what's this line, Deep? And I said, oh, that's your overtime pay. And this is in California. And I've never had that. So that wage theft happens in all levels. Some ways, like if a restaurant that's charging, I feel like, non-suppressed prices, there's more opportunity for them to pay their workers well. But if you're charging $4, $3 for a banh mi, how can you make that math work? The purpose of the article was to curb some of that demand. And it starts with the media. Like, just like stop feeding that, whatever that is, just stop feeding the expectation so that it doesn't pressure the immigrant restaurateur to suppress prices, which in turn would suppress wages. People think of, they might invest in chairs and tables because you have to have that for a restaurant and see those as investments, but they don't see their workers as investments. They'll cut those and they'll consider those as costs. Those are my business costs versus my investment. And I kind of want to just rethink that, like, your workers are your investment.
As restaurateurs, we understand that consistency is the bottom line of successful restaurants. That someone who comes a year from now and orders the same thing they ordered a year ago, that's the gold standard.
Yes.
And there's no other way to get that than to have less turnover in your employee base.
I agree.
You know, it's interesting because KCRW's Karen Fauché recently did a series that looked into, among other things, wage theft in L.A. It's called Burned, Abuse in L.A.'s Restaurant Industry. Some worked without overtime pay. Some found their tips stolen. Some worked many hours off the clock completely. And in fact, UCLA researchers have estimated that a staggering $26 million is stolen from low-wage workers each week in LA. But a culture of fear keeps most from speaking out. And this is happening at restaurants that have been lauded in the press as being wonderful immigrant-run restaurants in immigrant neighborhoods. So you say we prioritize price over labor.
Yes.
What's the way to get the word out to the consumer that we should understand that price goes up to respect labor?
I don't really want to lecture somebody. If you love a restaurant, you really love it for the feeling you get when you walk in, the feeling you get when you're eating. It's so intangible, right? What makes a restaurant a beloved restaurant?
It's the hospitality.
Yes, and it's all about based on desire, right? And so when you lecture somebody, it just becomes like school and becomes like a project. And it's all the subliminal things that we learn that I want to address, which is like, why is it that once a year, a magazine who usually highlights just kind of like really the higher end spectrum of food in Los Angeles, they come up with a cheap eats list. Oh my God, isn't this great? And somehow that list becomes like, you know, like you want to indulge in your proletariat side, supposed to be the celebration of these restaurants. But it's not. It's a celebration of how cheap they are. That is like their value is that they're cheap. And I think you can retool that to like, you know, we don't want to focus all the time on these high-end restaurants. You can say great neighborhood restaurants in our city. It would give you the same without saying it's cheap. What I do is that I feel like every time someone walks into my restaurant and orders a pho and pays $10 for it, and even they battle me on it, I say, I'm doing a service to the community. So you know that the next time you go into a pho restaurant, that is a suppressed price. I don't really know how to do it.
It's so interesting because you are, in essence, politicizing a bowl of pho.
Don't tell anybody.
but it's something that needs to be talked about.
Yes, it's so funny when you politicize it. The pho is great, you know, like the pho is so good. It's got marrow in there. You know, I want to seduce with that. And then in the end, you get some education. Great. If you don't, I'm not mad at you.
So I'm curious about Yelp. I know that because of this exact issue, you've experienced pushback on Yelp. Do you ever like have a little bit of a lecture on there?
I try not to read Yelp, I have to say. I get so much love from the community, so much love from the people who actually come. Because a lot of people, they write, they like had one thing and then they'll never come back. I'm kind of not concerned. For me, my customer base, it's really like a neighborhood. I'm not here to sell you one pho. And that's, I want to sell you pho for 10 years. So if I lose a few on the way, I think I'm okay with it.
Well, I remember a group of us at Good Food decided to go out for dinner together. We chose a restaurant in East Hollywood, and it was delicious. It's well known for being delicious. And then it was one of the restaurants featured in Karen Fauché's piece, Burned. Mm. And so then it's like, okay, well, I was schooled. I'm never going back there again. It just makes you so sad.
It does. And I have deep compassion for the immigrant restaurateur. I really feel like they're responding to what they consider public demand.
And they're trying to survive. And they have
yes.
so many different levels of fear that they're
yes.
dealing with.
Yeah. So I don't want to let them off the hook. But also, if you're going to put them on the hook, we put all of us on the hook for feeding that demand. If you're a food writer, if you're someone who's, hey, you know, shared on Facebook, the cheap eats list, everybody is involved in like that wage suppression. So it's, for me, it's not about cheap prices, it's about wage suppression.
Thank you so much for writing such an articulate article about a subject that is really important. But your point of view, I think, made it especially powerful.
Thank you, Evan. This wasn't written in a vacuum. This was written at a retreat that I attended with other chefs and writers of color, talking about racial justice in food. So this was like, what can we do given our different experiences and how do we tackle that?
Who convened the meeting?
Soul Summit and the Southern Foodways Alliance. John T. Edge was the person who invited me. I was going to say yes already, but when I heard that Tony Tipton Martin was involved, I'm like, yes, I just, you know, it was reinvigorating. When you just read food writing, it's so much about fashion. And really, when I got together with these women and men, it was about soul, it was about community, it was about justice. I've kind of been on just feeding off of that ever since.
Tony Titchmarsh, we should say, wrote the Aunt Jemima Code.
Yes.
Which is an extended bibliography of cookbooks written by African-American cooks.
Yes. I mean, talk about a cuisine and people who produce of that cuisine who are undervalued. She spends an entire book on that.
Deep Trans Restaurant, where the pho is worth every penny, is Good Girl Dinette. Find a link to the essay she wrote for NPR. It's called Cheap Eats, Cheap Labor, The Hidden Human Costs of Those Lists. It's on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Without immigrant farm workers, our dinner tables wouldn't look the same. That's who we'll hear from when our show continues. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. So many hands go into bringing our food to the table, starting on the farm. Our contributor, Scarlett Robertson, went to the Hollywood Farmers Market to meet the people behind our local produce, milk, mushrooms, eggs, and seafood.
Hi, my name is Thomas Gomez. I'm from Mexico, and we're selling eggs at the Farmers Market Hollywood with Lily's Eggs, the best in town.
My name is Jose Carranza. I was born in Mexico. We're here in Hollywood's Farmers Market, working for McGrath's Family Farms. I personally started working here almost a year ago, just selling. And my family, so my dad, my grandparents, and uncles have been working and selling and working the field for around 13 years now. We sell a little bit of everything, pretty much depending on the season. Right now, we have lots of greens. We have flowers, strawberries, and a lot of people pretty much enjoy the peas we have right now. It's really popular.
Hello, guten Tag. My name is Dirk Herman, and I'm selling mushrooms for LA Fungi, and I'm from Germany, Bavaria. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Yanto. I'm from Indonesia. I work here at the Farmers Market Hollywood. We're selling salad mix and fresh herbs, and our company name is Living Lettuce Farm.
Hello, I am Jose Ipazi from Ipazi Nursery. I am selling flower plants here in Hollywood Farmers Market for over 30 years. I come from Mexico, and I like to do this kind of work.
Hi, my name is Marilyn Saracusa. I currently own West Coast Seafood, and I was born in Iraq, Baghdad, and I came to the United States when I was 15, and that was 1979.
Hi, I'm Luis. I'm from Peru, and I sell berries at Paulo Berry Farms.
Okay, my name is Jesus Chavez. I came from Mexico. I bring vegetables and fruit, strawberries. And the name of the farm is J&J Farm. From Santa Maria.
My name is Minor Ixco. I was born in Guatemala. Yeah, so I work for Organic Pastures. They're a small dairy that have been doing raw dairy for over 17 years.
My name is Blanca Bolaños. Es del Salvador. Mi es a Burki Greenhouse, es por Espraos. My family is Bolaños, family is Espraos. I love you, Estados Unidos, and I'm happy, happy. Thank you.
That montage comes to us from our contributor, Scarlett Robertson, and KCRW's independent producer project. She talked to Thomas from Lily's Eggs, Jose from McGrath Family Farm, Dirk from LA Fungi, Yang To from Living Lettuce Farms, Jose from Ipazi Nursery, Marilyn from West Coast Seafood, Luis from Pudwill Berry Farms, Jesus from J&J Farms, Miner from Organic Pastures, and Blanca from Bolaños Family Sprouts. The moment Donald Trump hit the campaign trail, he promised to tighten up immigration policies, aggressively deport illegal immigrants, and build that famous wall between the U.S. and Mexico. When he took the oath, President Trump put the wheels in motion. Here in California, some 45% of ag workers are undocumented. We called a dairyman in the Central Valley, Steve Maddox, to hear what farmers are thinking about the new administration's stance on immigration. Steve, how big is your dairy in Riverdale?
I have 65 employees.
And how many heads of cattle?
We're milking 3,000 head cows.
Wow. while President Trump lost the state of California to Hillary Clinton in the election, he did have support from a large contingent of the farming community. Did you vote for him?
Yeah, I voted for change.
And how do you expect Trump's policies regarding immigration to play out on your farm?
Well, until everything's in black and white, there's always a little bit of concern. But so far, he's been doing what he said he's going to do for a variety of issues that he ran on. And he is honoring, so far, the DACA group.
What percentage of your labor force was born in another country?
You know, probably is over 90%, 80 to 90%.
And have most of those folks been with you for a long time?
Yes, some up to almost 40 years.
So have they moved from, like, field workers to become supervisors as well?
Yes.
I would imagine that it's almost like a second family.
I've got a really great staff, good people. You know, also being on the local school board, they have great kids.
Though Trump outlined his intentions regarding immigration during the campaign, some of his supporters are being kind of taken aback and surprised by how his policies are being implemented, how quickly they're being implemented. Are you surprised at all?
I'm a little bit surprised at how quickly, yeah, that some of them are being carried out, although there's a little confusion in finding out which of these actions, at least on immigration, were actually programmed greater than 40 days ago and how much were not. But with a change of memorandum or executive order, how they're doing the final determinations on, like, some of these deportation orders.
Yes, yeah, some of the deportation orders include green card holders. Have you heard concern on behalf of your staff?
Yes, my staff is concerned. I also have some people that were born here that are concerned because of all the rhetoric, particularly on some of the immigration advocates, maybe spreading a little extra information to encourage people to express their frustrations with it. But a lot of it is misinformation. But yeah, there is some green card holders that are being apparently asked to leave or being guided to leave, mainly because of breaking the law.
What are your thoughts on legalizing farm workers, those that do the work that Americans seem not to want to do? Do you think there should be another program like the Bracero program?
I think once we clean up the current workers here at this time, perhaps we should have something a little different than H-2A visa program that really isn't really easy to deal with and very difficult to carry out and very expensive.
Tell us a little bit about that program for those who aren't familiar with it.
Well, the H-2A visa program is something like when you're bringing over people for high-tech companies, nurses and doctors, veterinary people, some of our mechanics and things like that would almost qualify under that. In the last 10 years, it's been very difficult to find farm workers, and we're having a challenge trying to find people to fill the spots.
Have you heard so far of any raids, immigration raids, at farms in your part of the Central Valley?
No. You know, basically the farms of the Central Valley have been very, over the years, we've gone to a lot of the seminars and hearings by six different agencies, from social services to ICE to Farm Bureau and their state people telling us how to hire, what rules we have to follow, you know, when to question paperwork, when not to, where to check to make sure the paperwork is at least seems correct.
So in the months ahead, I would imagine that for you, it's really a waiting game when it comes to further recruiting or retaining workers, waiting to see how it's all going to get played out.
We've had very little turnover, but yes, I mean, it's of a major concern until it's in black and white and how they're going to program it out. If you look at the Affordable Care Act, they're still determining rules on that one this many years later. And it's possible that the new immigration laws or the new immigration solution may take many years of interpretation.
Well, maybe as things go forward, we'll be able to come back and talk to you again as it plays out.
Well, I hope so. It's interesting. I mean, we've had so many scare tactics out there and things like that. But like I said, we're required to check paperwork. We've got multiple I-9 things, but it's kind of between a rock and a hard place. Hopefully they'll come through here with a little bit of, empathy and get it fixed. And because eventually they are going to have to increase the penalties on employers?
Yeah, it's kind of a quagmire for the employer.
It's a quagmire for all sides. It's time to fix it. The problem is both parties have been unwilling to fix it. Ever since the original DREAM Act was stopped by the White House in December 2010, because it was just after an election, it's too early in the election process. And then they did a presidential order a year and a half later.
And you would have liked to have seen the DREAM Act passed?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Humane.
Yeah, it's humane. And it would have been done properly instead of what we have now that's a little flawed that they need to fix. But you have productive members of society that, you know, need to be recognized. And again, that's just something that they're eventually going to have to come up to. And I strongly believe that the empathy on that one will be rectified. Realizing our current president is actually socially moderate versus some of the other conservatives out there.
Let's hope.
Well, I certainly hope he is, huh?
Steve Maddox owns Maddox Dairy in Riverdale, California. Up next, we move from the farm to where the sausage gets made. That's right, we're talking about slaughterhouses. Stay with us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Like cheap meat? Why is it so cheap? Well, who do you think works in all those slaughterhouses? So far in the show, we focused on the largely immigrant workforce of American restaurants and farms. Now, let's move to the slaughterhouse, where for years, refugees have been accepting low-paying, dangerous jobs to process our meat and keep it cheap. We invited the largest meat processor in the world, Tyson Foods, to the show. We wanted to discuss how Trump's travel ban on immigrants from Muslim-majority countries would affect the hiring pool. Tyson did not return our request for an interview, but Tom Philpott did. He's been covering the issue for Mother Jones. Tom, why are refugees a key labor source for slaughterhouses?
That's a really good question. Well, it's not a job that's particularly attractive. It's extremely low paying. According to the Department of Labor, average wages are about $10 or $11 an hour. It's one of the more dangerous jobs. It's very unpleasant. And as a result, for years and years now, they've relied on immigrants, often undocumented immigrants. But crackdowns on immigration in the mid-2000s kind of sent the industry into a bit of a crisis. And one of the answers has been to invite refugees in. They are documented immigrants. They tend to be coming from very bad situations. They need jobs. And so here's an industry that offers them jobs.
Wow. It's like preying on desperation.
It is a little bit. And, you know, in one sense, it's really nothing new. I mean, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, written in 1906, was about the exploitation of immigrants, very disempowered immigrants in the stockyards of Chicago at the turn of the 20th century. But, you know, what happened after that, there's a lot of union organizing, and by mid-century, it was a tough job. I mean, no one wants to work in a slaughterhouse. I mean, very few people would want that job. But wages were essentially on par with manufacturing. So people in that job had a decent middle-class wage. Mostly native-born Americans worked those jobs by that time in places like Chicago. But what happened after that was a move to bust the unions and move out of cities like Chicago into sparsely populated rural areas where they could get away with paying lower wages. And that sort of is what got us back to where we are today, which is a bit like going back to the jungle of the Upton Sinclair era.
And what countries do most immigrant or refugee laborers come from?
For about the last 15 or 20 years, Mexico and Central America have been the major source of immigrant workers in this sector. With the crackdowns of the 2000s, those numbers have leveled off a little bit. And now what you're getting is largely Somali refugees. So what you have here are, you know, mostly Muslim people and people from a country that is on the list that Donald Trump wants to bar from immigrating here at all. And so they're sort of two-time losers. A, because they're refugees, he's banning all refugees, and B, because they're from Somalia, which is one of the countries that he's singled out for banning. And so for that reason, you know, they fall into the crosshairs two different times. It's interesting that this is the very group of workers that the meat industry has been relying on for a while now.
When Somali workers came in, did they displace other workers or were they sort of just added to the mix?
They were sort of just added to the mix because American meat consumption has generally leveled off in recent years, but exports have been booming. And as a result, the industry has been scaling up and it's needed to not only replace workers who leave, it's a very high turnover kind of occupation, but it's also had to hire new workers. And so, no, there's no sense in which the Somali workers have displaced anyone. They have been added to a situation where there's growing demand for labor, not shrinking demand for labor.
So let's talk about the danger of the job. What are some of the injuries and the illnesses that affect employees that work in the meatpacking industry?
Let's think about a chicken slaughterhouse for a second. You've got birds coming by at the rate of about 140 per minute, which is just, to me, just a mind-boggling rate. The work is very specialized. You've got a group of workers that just do one thing, that snap the head off or snap the wings off. They're making the same motion over and over again, often with sharp knives. And so obviously cuts are one of the hazards. But the biggest hazard of all is obviously repetitive stress injuries. And there's been various studies about this, but those are rampant in the industry. People hurt their wrists, they hurt other joints. The other thing is that also in poultry, there's been a great increase in the use of antibacterial sprays. And so these are things like literally bleach. You get these mists of bleach and other sort of noxious chemicals in the air. And so respiratory illnesses in the poultry industry are also a very big thing.
Do these people have any health insurance?
They don't get health insurance through the company typically unless, you know, some of the shop floors are unionized and have benefits. But for the most part, these are not unionized shop floors. And so, there are no benefits to working in this industry. Medical insurance is a big problem for these workers.
Because a lot of these types of injuries are lifelong.
Oh, yeah. If you get carpal tunnel syndrome or some other repetitive motion injury, it can last for a very, very long time.
So I'm curious, the meat industry, did they support Trump or Clinton?
That's a really good question. When I did some research on that during the election and sort of tallied up the campaign contributions, I found that the meat industry did support Trump. He got a lot more money from the meat industry than Clinton did. And, you know, this is one of the contradictions of Trumpism. You know, the entire industry relies a lot on immigrant labor and are not too keen on these crackdowns. Even the ICE raids are impacting farms and slaughterhouses. On the one hand, he's vowed to roll back regulations, various regulations on the meat industry. On the other hand, his sort of xenophobic policies are attacking the very pool of labor that they rely on. And so you're seeing some tensions come out. The American Meat Institute has come out strongly against Trump's refugee ban. Other players in the industry have as well, but they did support him.
And then there's this other kind of double whammy, which nobody really knows what's going to happen to trade. And food exports have always been an easy target for retaliatory tariffs.
That's true. And this is an industry, like I was saying before, it completely relies on not just open export markets, but ever-increasing exports. And, you know, if you're going to tear up NAFTA and, you know, destroy the TPP, you're hurting the interests of that industry. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But you're exactly right that, you know, if we get into a trade war with Mexico, food exports are going to be a big part of that.
You spoke earlier about how so many of these plants now are in these sort of more isolated rural areas. What does the influx of these immigrants or refugees do to these areas?
On the one hand, they have a positive effect because we've seen over the past 30 or 40 years the sort of hollowing out of rural America. As farms get bigger and bigger, fewer and fewer people work on them. And so in places like Iowa and all over the Midwest and rural North Carolina, you get this sort of population drop in these small towns and you get dying towns. And so when you get an influx of immigrants, you know, people make things more vibrant. And so you get, you know, local economies in some of these areas boosting. You get, you know, all of a sudden you get a Mexican shop or a Somali shop, and that's good for the local economy. On the other hand, though, you get definite tensions and you get, you know, xenophobia and racism comes out. We've seen that over and over again in places like Minnesota, some towns in Iowa that have had sudden influxes of Mexicans or Somalis. Tensions do arise. But I think that, you know, since our rural populations have been declining so much, it, you know, it could be seen as a positive that people are actually coming in.
So what's the takeaway?
This is an industry that has, you know, basically for 30 or 40 years relied on producing as much meat as possible, as cheaply as possible. One of the consequences of that is the sort of attack on organized labor, the sort of downward pressure on wages, and that has made it seek out over and over again the most desperate group of workers it can get its hands on, whether it's undocumented workers from Mexico or Guatemala, whether now it's Somali refugees. In addition to thinking about whether or not it's fair to have a ban on refugees, or whether it's smart to have a ban on refugees, or whether it's smart to target certain countries and say your immigrants can't come in, we also need to be looking at how can we make the meat industry more fair to workers? How can we raise the playing field in the meat industry so not only the most desperate people will work in it?
Find a link to Refugees Make Your Dinner, literally, which Tom Philpott wrote for Mother Jones, on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we look at how President Trump's wall and proposed import tax on Mexican goods might change the cost of your mezcal cocktail. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
There is a lot of speculation as to, because I am Mexican, whether or not, you know, like the U.S. wants to continue doing trade with Mexico. I don't think that's ever going to happen. I feel like we're one of the most important trading partners of the U.S. And not only do we sell things to the U.S., but the U.S. sells things to us.
That's Cecilia Rios Murrieta. She was born in Mexico City, now lives in L.A. Since she's always traveling south of the border to meet mezcal producers in Oaxaca and Sonora, trade and borders are often on her mind. Murrieta started a mezcal company with her mom 6 years ago. It's called La Niña del Mezcal. Cecilia, for the uninformed, what's the difference between tequila and mezcal?
The main difference between tequila and mezcal is the denomination of origin. Tequila is made with one specific varietal of agave called the Tequilana Weber, and there is a specific region assigned for the production of tequila, mostly in the state of Jalisco and a couple other regions in Guanajuato, Tamaulipas, Nayarit, Michoacán. The DO for mezcal covers 8 states in Mexico, and the main one is Oaxaca, and that's where we're producing our mezcal. But the beauty of mezcal is that you can make mezcal out of any varietal of agave that you find within that DO.
So you and your mom founded La Niña.
Mm-hmm.
6 years ago. Why?
Why? Oh my God. For me, it's a combination of fate and just being at the right moment at the right time. My love for Oaxaca was really, I'm not from Oaxaca. I was born in Mexico City. So my connection with Oaxaca was non-existent up until 2009. And then that was the first time I went down there with my brother and a couple friends. And I just fell in love. I fell in love with the culture. I fell in love with the people. I fell in love with the architecture and the colors and just this vibrant feeling that you get when you go into Oaxaca. And mezcal, of course, was a part of that.
How did you find the partner that you have, the 5 small family farms and distilleries who make your product?
Ever since we launched the first production, which was the Espadin, when we go back to Oaxaca, we dedicate our time not only working with our existing producers, but also exploring. So we'll just get on the road and we'll try to discover new little towns. We'll go into San Juan del Rio, Santa Maria, and we're constantly just kind of on the lookout of new productions. And then once we find a good production that we like and we get to know the families, then we create that bond and we continue this working relationship with them.
So it's almost like the type of mezcal production you're talking about is akin to a small farm-to-table operation.
Yes. For example, for our wild agaves, we usually only bottle one production at every year. In terms of volume, that means we only get 500 to 1,000 liters tops in 1 year. That's our production for whatever we're going to sell around the U.S.
And of course, the big challenge with both tequila and mezcal is that the agave takes so long to mature.
Mm-hmm. Yes. In the cases of some varietals like Espadine, they may take up to 11, 12 years. In the case of a wild agave like a Tepic Statis, sometimes even 30 years.
So I understand that you also have a production that doesn't take place in Oaxaca. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yes. A couple of years into our business, my mom and I, we started looking outwards in terms of the regions. Getting involved with mezcal, you start getting involved with everything that is Mexico. We met a producer from Sonora, and he has been cultivating Espadine agave in a small town called San Pedro de la Cueva in Sonora. The agave spirits that are being made in this region are called Bacanora because they have their own denomination of origin. The spirit called Bacanora, even though it's in essence a type of mezcal, it can only be made within 35 municipalities of the state of Sonora. And in our case, it's basically an Espadine agave spirit made with a completely different terroir.
Why don't you pour a tiny, yeah, tiny little bit of the Bacanora? That's enough. and the cereal. Oh, it's interesting. The Bacanora has a less smoky nose.
Yes. For the production of our Bacanora, we're actually steaming our agave. So this is the only production that we have where the agaves are not cooked in the traditional manner, which is underground with wood. In this case, we're steaming the agave. So what you're tasting is the pure expression of that agave.
It's delicious. It tastes sweeter. It's mm-hmm. slightly sweeter and a bit more floral rather than vegetal. Sometimes agaves taste grassy.
Yes. Since these agaves are growing in a very arid area, the state of Sonora is known to be a desert. They're under a more hostile environment, and therefore they keep more sugars in their core. And that's why you're getting that first initial flavor is that sweetness, that very ripe agave sweetness.
Now I'm going to taste the cereal, which is the wild agave.
Yes. This is a wild agave from the Kerwinski family. This is from the small town of Santa Maria Soquitlan.
Kerwinski, that doesn't sound very Mexican to me.
No, that is the botanical name for this specific varietal of agave. All the agaves, like Espadine, its botanical name is Angustifolia haw. In the case of cereal, it's Kerwinski. The tobolas are known as potatorums. But cereal is basically the colloquial name.
It also is light in smokiness, but it has... It's very smooth.
Yes. That's almost all of our mezcals are very easy to taste. And that's in essence how we choose which producers we work with. I like to drink mezcals that have a lot of character and a lot of flavor and not so much punch in terms of alcohol that sometimes people assimilate mezcal with. For me, mezcal is more about expressing this identity and this difference between the varietals. When you taste through our line, you can really taste the essence of each varietal. An Espadine is going to be more citric and more fruity. This cereal is a lot more greener and it has these hints of aloe and nopal and kind of pininess to it as well. And I like to choose productions that say that as opposed to just tasting the alcohol.
Yeah, because for me, I mean, what sets mezcal apart, really good mezcal, is that it's a wonderful sipping beverage.
Yes.
Not a pounding beverage.
No, I always try to tell people to enjoy and sip their mezcals and really just taste it and take your time with it and accompany it with food or some cheese or some salt, sal de gusano, which is very traditional in Oaxaca.
Worm salt.
And really play with it because it's a spirit that has been produced for over 400 years, but also the time that it took to make the specific bottle, like the specific offering, it's a lot, not only in the years of the agave growing, but the production time takes about a month total from the picking of the agave to a complete distillation. So really, just when you're going to sip this, take your time and enjoy it and listen to what the agave has to say.
I understand that one of your producers actually uses horses in the process.
Yes, almost all of them.
Really?
Yes. Once the agave has been cooked, we take it out of the oven, and we have to grind it to be able to release those sweet juices that were all cooked. And so the traditional grinding process in Oaxaca is called a taona, and that's a huge stone that is being pulled by a horse, and it's just kind of going around this center. And that's just the way that the agave gets crushed and gets ready for fermentation.
How do you think Trump's proposed tax on Mexican imports will affect your business?
For us, mezcal is already an expensive product as it is. It's expensive because it's special and it takes time to make and it's not easy to make. And by the time it's produced in the facility, by the time it crosses the border, comes all the way from Oaxaca up to whatever border you're going to introduce it through, by the time it makes it to the retail shops, there's already these increments of price. A 20% tax on that would definitely affect our business. I think people who drink mezcal will drink it nevertheless. People who want to drink mezcal will find it, and they will be able to find a way to pay for it. But it will make our job more difficult, I think, and in terms of explaining to people the value of what we're making. Hopefully that's not going to happen, and we'll be able to continue as we are. You know, maybe that's a sign for us to say we have to look towards other markets and explore whether it's China or Europe, or see where people want to drink mezcal.
How do you split your time between Southern California and Mexico?
I try to be here as much as I can. We're still a very small company, so my job is pretty much doing everything from coordinating export to coming over here and doing representation and sales. I try to spend a month in Mexico and go to Oaxaca every other 3 months. And then when I'm here, I'm constantly on the move and traveling.
Have you and your mother found it challenging to be women in the mezcal business?
Yes, it's definitely a challenge. It was in the very beginning when we decided to venture out into small towns and go into Oaxaca and in search of our first production. There were a lot of people who advised us not to go into certain areas and not to go alone. And my mom, she's from Sonora. She's very tall and she has a very strong voice. And she's always had this like very imposing presence. And I don't think anything has ever scared her. So she kind of rubs that off on me sometimes. And the two of us, we just, you know, like whenever someone says we can't do something, we prove them wrong. It is a challenge, but it's not anything that we can't handle.
Find out more about Cecilia Rios Murrieta and La Niña del Mezcal on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can always listen to the show at kcrw.com or on KCRW's new updated mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. They are
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine,
Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.